Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the role ranchers have played in Western politics is a big one. And we'll round up some of our best summer podcast recommendations. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap. And first, let's hear some voices from the news this week.
Kamala Harris and the administration wants to fix this problem. She's worked on this problem, you know, for 3.5 years, and it's a challenging problem.
The dreams we have for our country and for our families, they are on the ballot in November. And this is why we have got to reelect Donald J. Trump, President of the United States. We've got to do everything that we can to get President Trump over that finish line.
It's just a real outpouring, and it's overwhelming. I'm just honored that they put their trust in me, and I'm just hoping that can make them all proud.
People know that we're going to fight for them, and we know that it's a strong campaign. It helps to also have a very exciting campaign on the top of the ticket, too.
Who is ready to save this country?
This morning, I am joined by two politicos from both sides of the aisle. We have Stacey Pearson, Democratic consultant with Lumen Strategies, and former state school superintendent Jaime Molera, now with the firm Molera Alvarez. Good morning to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so obviously a very big week in politics here in Arizona. We had a primary election. We had a vice presidential contender visit. We have another vice presidential contender possibly in our midst. So lots to talk about. And I want to start with the former there. Let's start with Senator Mark Kelly. So much chatter about him being maybe in the final, maybe two contenders for Kamala Harris's VP pick. It's heating up. Word has it she'll make a selection by Tuesday. Kelly says, though, he will be in Arizona next week. People reading into every bit of scheduling happening here. Stacey, I want to start with you. Do you think this will really happen? What are the odds?
Oh, I think the odds are good, right? Arizona has elected him twice. A red state has elected him twice. And certainly it's against some crazy candidates that he was running against. But his resume is extraordinary. And the nation could use some of Mark Kelly.
The nation could use it. Jaime, how smart do you think it would be for the Harris campaign to pick somebody like Kelly for those reasons, but also for location, right, for Arizona, for the swing state status here? Would she be better off picking somebody like, you know, the governor of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro? There's, you know, maybe more votes to be had there in the Electoral College.
Well, the thing about Senator Kelly is that he brings a lot to the table, not just electoral votes, and certainly Arizona is going to be a battleground state. But being a former military hero, being a former astronaut, being all those things that I think appeal to a lot of Americans. And I think his stature in the United States Senate, along with everything that else he's accomplished, and not the least of which is being married to Gabby Giffords, who's also extremely popular.
Yeah.
You could just see him being a very powerful force on that ticket. And it's interesting when, as these rumors are starting to circulate and percolate, I think Governor Hobbs is going to get a lot more Christmas cards this year if that were to happen, because there'd be a lot of people interested in that job.
Yeah, I mean, that's the next step kind of question, right, Stacey? Like, what do you think this sets up in terms of somebody to replace him potentially?
Well, I think that's probably his biggest liability, is putting that seat back in contention in 2 years.
Yeah.
And we saw what happened with Obama's first term when he had control of the House and the Senate. There was a backlash 2 years later. Mm-hmm. And so putting that seat up to up for that interim election unnecessarily, I think, is going to be his biggest liability.
Interesting. Let me ask you, Jaime, about the border here. Like, that's perceived to be one of Kamala Harris's, you know, political weaknesses. Obviously, we're a border state. Kelly's from here. He's from Tucson. Is that something he could help with?
Possibly. It is a big issue for the Democrats in this election cycle, because right now, every poll that I've seen, security border issues are number one.
Yeah.
And usually when they're number one, it's better for Republicans, usually. I think Senator Kelly will help mitigate that to some extent. But still, that's going to be an area the Republicans are going to be really hitting the Democrats hard at all levels, not just in this presidential race.
Yeah. Stacey, what does Kelly's record look like on the border? Like, how has he approached the issue in the past?
Well, certainly the border bill that got scuttled, you know, crushed earlier this year by candidate Trump, Kelly was a leader on and getting that across, getting that out of the Senate. He understands what needs to be done. We have a congressional stalemate. That's the problem. We're not funding through our Congress, our absolute concrete set psychotic Congress. We're not funding better technology, faster processing, better background checks, more Border Patrol agents. And Mark Kelly certainly understands that.
Yeah. Okay. So everyone excited for Tuesday. Jaime, you think this is going to happen?
Well, I think there's a very, very good chance. I would say right now it's a coin flip. I think they're looking at all aspects of it. Certainly, Governor Shapiro gives a lot of impact for the possible ticket just because of the electoral votes Pennsylvania brings, but also the region.
Yeah.
The Midwest region is going to be so important. So I think there's a lot of folks doing a lot of poll watching and number crunching.
And waiting. Okay. So Kelly or no Kelly on the ticket, right? It seems that Arizona is going to be, you know, inundated for the next 3 months here until November. We just had J.D. Vance here this week. We've got Kamala Harris coming. What is Arizona's status heading into November, Stacey? Like, we have heard this shift in recent weeks, but then maybe it's shifted again as the entire presidential race has shifted, right? Are we a toss-up state or are we leans Republican, as the Cook Political Report reclassified us?
Oh, make no mistake, we are Republican. Hmm. We absolutely are. There are more registered Republicans than Democrats or independents, but we have consistently rejected crazy people. So despite our Republican registration advantage, we have not elected MAGA in quite some time. So we look at Governor Hobbs, who defeated Kerry Lake. We look at Senator Kelly, who defeated Blake Masters. We look at Paul Penzone, even, which was the beginning of this, who defeated Joe Arpaio. We are a Republican state with sane conservative principles.
What's your take there, Jaime?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said about that. I think if you look at Kerry Lake's numbers, for instance, her negatives are pretty significant. I mean, they're above 50%. And that's always difficult to come back on. It's always difficult to change a person's perception if they don't like you, if they have a negative opinion of you. And so that gives the Democrats an opportunity. Ruben Gallego, if he were running against a John Kyle, for instance, or some what I would call traditional conservative, I think he'd have a hard time winning.
Yeah.
But in this era, he's going to have an opportunity to become the next U.S. senator from Arizona.
Yeah. Let me ask you about something you just brought up, Stacey, which is the registration numbers, right, which has shifted recently again. They always kind of shift heading into a primary, but it seems more dramatic this time. We're seeing Republicans in the state with this growing and really pretty significant registration advantage over Democrats. Independents also big registration advantage over Democrats. Is this as significant as the numbers make it seem?
Yes. It's literally keeping me up at night. Where did they go? You know, we are roughly 100,000 fewer registered Democrats today than we were 4 years ago.
Huh.
And that is significant when both other big blocks of voters have grown. And so our gap, I mean, Democrats had a 20,000 voter gap 4 years ago over independents. Now we're underwater by 250,000. So where did they go? Where did the Democrats go? Why did they leave? Why won't they come back? Someone go find them. If they're listening right now, call me. I'll help you. I'll help you get through your voter registration. It's we really need to figure out what is happening and then make sure that we're talking to those voters. You know, it's probably, you know, there's 1,000 theories, but they've moved. If it's new residents, they've moved here from California. They were probably lifelong registered Democrats. Why did they register as independents? Was it traffic? Is it policy issues? Or were they mad about traffic and homelessness and crime? Or, you know, what's happening? We have to figure it out.
And there really aren't answers to that right now. We're really just guessing.
Right now, it's guessing. And I talk more about this right now with clients and funders and campaigns than anything else. Border policy is third to where did the Democrats go and how are we going to get them back?
So from the Republican side of that, Jaime, then, I mean, like, that big of a voter advantage, a registration advantage, I think it's like 260,000, right, more Republicans than Democrats. Like, this is significant. Does that guarantee wins, though, in a lot of these races?
No, it certainly helps.
Yeah.
But the Republicans need to figure out a way to make sure that they vote. Not only vote, but they vote Republican. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Republican women, for instance, that have a big problem with President Trump, particularly on abortion issues. That tends to be a huge wedge issue. But if they can focus on areas of, for instance, the border, if they can focus on the economy, certainly some of the data coming out showing that the United States might be going into a recession certainly will not help this administration. Those are the kinds of things they need to be focused on, and they really need to drive the debate and the focus of this election on those issues.
Are we seeing that happen?
Starting to. I think to various degrees. I think you've seen that at different levels. For instance, the state legislature, that's going to be a big battle and whether or not the Democrats can maybe get control over that.
Yeah.
But I think the Republican message has been very consistent and very strong on those areas that I just talked about.
Do you agree, Stacey?
Well, I think certainly politicians who have discipline are talking about those issues very well. And then you've got the top of the ticket in Donald Trump, who's just bonkers, right? Who's questioning whether or not Kamala Harris turned black last week. I mean, we're really talking about some crazy top of ticket issues. But, you know, looking at going into this upcoming election, we see where the Democrats are going. It is abortion, 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 freedom, freedom, freedom.
Mm. Are those going to be winning issues, you think?
Absolutely. I mean, you think through the number of signatures that the abortion measure just turned in. I mean, 800,000, north of 800,000 signatures. There were 7,000 volunteers. I've worked on ballot initiatives now for almost a decade, and I've never seen numbers anywhere near that.
Let me ask you about that, Jaime. I mean, like, is abortion going to be as central in November as it was maybe a year ago?
I don't think it will, because I think we've had this debate now, and there's going to be an initiative on the ballot where people can decide what they want to do. So if Republicans, again, focus on the top issues that are in people's minds right now, which is the economy, that's first and foremost, and feeling secure in our state, that's going to be the messages that they're going to need to have in order to be successful. I just think that while abortion is a big issue, and I think it can be a wedge issue for Republicans, if they can stay committed to that message and focused on what they need to do, then I think they might have a lot of success.
Yeah, we can see your advice here to clients right now. All right, we'll be back with more of that in just a minute. Stacey Pearson, Jaime Malera, more of the Friday Newscap after the break. Good morning. You are listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5, and we are in the midst of the Friday Newscap. I am joined this morning by Jaime Malera, former state school superintendent, now with Malera Alvarez, and Stacey Pearson with Lumen Strategies. Thanks for both of you for being here. Let's jump right back in and get into the primaries, which we haven't even gotten to because so much is happening right now in politics. Big primary election this week. Lots of things I want to talk about, but I want to start with the most, probably one of the most watched races, at least coming out of this primary, which was the Maricopa County Recorder race, a race that used to not be political almost at all and no one really thought about, but now is hugely political for the last several cycles because of election denialism. Stephen Richer lost this primary. He has spent his entire term defending election integrity in the state as a conservative Republican, fending off election denialism. He lost to Justin Heap, who hasn't outright denied the election results of the last two elections, but has voted to do things like restrict early voting, ban electronic tabulation machines. Jaime, I want to ask you about this. What does it mean, two elections going forward, that Richer lost here?
Well, I think it would have been much more significant had a couple of the county supervisor races gone differently. So, for instance, Thomas Galvin ended up holding on to his seat against challenger Jenty Rita. Now, she would have been much more aggressive in attacking. Kay Brophy McGee also won her primary. So that might provide some kind of an ability to keep a lid on what happens, similar to when Joe Arpaio was sheriff and the county supervisors were always a battle with him. But they were the ultimate overseers of whatever the policy was. So I think that's going to be a significant. Now, the Democrat challenger, I think, has new life running against Justin Heap. But it'll be interesting to see how if he comes out and runs as a what I call a traditional conservative, then I think he has a good chance of winning.
Okay, so that is a really good point, right? Because we're looking at now an entirely new race with a candidate on the Democrat side, Stacey, who no one has really heard of. Tim Stringham has an interesting history and reason for getting into this race, I've read very recently. But tell us a little bit about the race that this sets up.
So he's done a phenomenal job right out of the gate explaining to people who he is. Mm-hmm. That said, you know, some of my most politically connected friends said, mm-hmm. who is Tom Stringbow? And, which is not his name.
I was about to correct you.
Tim Stringham. but certainly we're all going to know his name very, very quickly. And I think we're going to see some significant investments in the democracy defense folks that are kind of floating, like the funders, these guys that kind of float in the dark clouds and spend money in races. We're going to see lots of money spent in this race to make sure it doesn't fall to a guy that believes that mail-in ballots need to go away.
So, I mean, where does Justin Heap stand on some of this? Because he's been a little bit in the middle on some things. He's, like I said, not come outright and said, you know, these elections were stolen. You're saying, Jaime, if he runs this and kind of stays away from those extremisms, he might be able to win it?
I think so. I think just because we talked about earlier, the registration advantage that the Republicans have in Maricopa County could be a difficult thing for somebody to overcome. Now, it can happen. I mean, a lot of people didn't know who Adrian Fuentes was either when he ran for county recorder. So there's always that possibility. But I'm a big believer in these elections. Republicans have to be disciplined and they have to show the voters that they're going to be attacking the issues that Arizonans care about, not just what the fringe element says they need to be talking about.
What is the party look like right now on the GOP side? Like, how much of the party is going to be under the MAGA wing, and how much is what you're saying, you know, is more traditional Republican conservative?
Well, I'm sure Stacey has some thoughts about that.
I actually have a diagram.
I think that the Republican Party right now, if you look at these primaries that just happened,
right,
it was not dominated by all the MAGA candidates.
But a lot of them won,
but it wasn't dominated by it. Yeah. And I think you're starting to see folks like I said, Kate Brophy McGee, Vince Leach, for instance, beats mm-hmm. Justine Watzak down in the Pima County area. Mm-hmm. Those were pretty significant wins. And it allows Republicans to stay away from what I would call some of the craziness of these elections discussions and debates. And if they can get those kinds of candidates in place, then Democrats are going to have a hard time winning.
Stacey?
We will not have a hard time winning. But in my office, we actually drew a center line kind of representing moderate policy, right? Kind of common sense, everybody agrees policy. There were far more MAGA candidates that won. And the Democrats who won were closer to that line. Mm. And so the more extreme Democrats did not win. But, you know, and Jaime pointed out the anomalies in there. But we have a Fincham who beat Ken Bennett. And we've got other lunatics that beat traditional conservative candidates. And so I think it's going to be a wild ride. And all of that's going to play into November and whether or not the Democrats can take a chamber.
Right. So let's talk about that, because the Democrats have been talking about trying to take one or both of the chambers in the state legislature for so long. They really want to do this. There's already this big campaign. The governor seems to be launching right now, multi-million-dollar campaign to try to flip at least one of these chambers. Stacey, it's looking right now like this is more likely in the Senate than the House.
Certainly. The Senate is the best chance. But what I think we're going to focus on, what we're going to see the Democrats do for the first time, is talk about what's possible with a Democratic governor and a governing majority, even if it's just some moderate Republicans in the House and the Senate. And if we can zoom out a little bit and talk about restoring full day kindergarten and talk about some common sense limits on the school voucher program and talk about better funded transportation, at feeding kids lunch, you know, getting people better access to medical care. I think we've got the best chance we've ever had of taking those chambers.
What do you think, Jaime?
Well, I think the best that the Democrats can do is split the Senate. That's mm-hmm. the very best they can do, because I think with Vince Leach's win in the primary, surprising win in the primary, that takes a seat away from the Democrats. I think Vince is going to be very difficult to
beat.
Right,
they thought they might be able to beat Justine Watzak.
Shauna Bullock is the other senator that they're targeting.
North Phoenix district there, yeah.
I wouldn't consider her to be one of the hard right MAGA-type candidates. I mean, she's very fiscally conservative, very conservative. I think that's the one they're going to target and try and, like I said, split the Senate. But that's the best they can do, in my opinion.
You don't think it's going to happen?
I don't. I think Shauna is a very disciplined and formidable campaigner. I know Judy Schwiebert's a good candidate also. But again, with the the numbers favoring the Republicans, especially in those districts, if, again, they go back to the messaging, if they stay on message and they talk about those things that Arizonans care about, particularly border security and the economy, I think the Republicans should do well.
What do you think the issues are going to look like here at the local level, Stacey?
So I think the budget is going to be the biggest issue. You know, how do you get blood out of a rock, really? With, you know, there's we're not looking at an increase in taxes on the foreseeable future. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So where do you make cuts to fund priorities that Arizonans care about? And we're going to have to talk about meaningful criminal justice reform. We have to. We've got one of the largest populations in prisons in the country. And the worst recidivism rates. Like, it's not working. We're going to have to figure something else out there. We're going to have to talk about getting education funding back on track, both K through 12 and college education. I mean, tuitions are too high. I think we're going to be talking about the issues that really matter most to people when they're sitting at home on a Sunday trying to figure out whether or not they can pay their bills next week.
Yeah. Kitchen table issues at the very most. If the Democrats do get control or at least split one of the chambers, right, are we just looking at more gridlock then? Like, what does that do if they don't take total control?
Well, I think it's very much going to be this governing majority. There are going to be, you know, what Kate Brophy McGee used to be in the legislature, the Democrats will make friends with moderate Republicans who see what jobs need to be done, what their job really is.
You're talking about actual bipartisanship?
I know it's a weird concept, but yes, sometimes Republicans and Democrats can come together on issues that matter.
Okay.
So I think that's what the focus is going to be.
What do you think, Jaime? Is that possible in this climate?
Sure. I think that the governor is certainly wanting to see at least a split Senate, because I think that gives them a lot more leverage, particularly on how they deal with the budget issues. But I agree with Stacey. The budget is going to be paramount. And I don't think people understand how significant the deficits are right now. And it's going to get worse.
Exactly.
So there's going to be a lot of weight that's going to fall on the governor to try and pull this together, try and build those kinds of coalitions. But it makes it a lot more difficult if the Republicans are in control.
Yeah. Okay. So final minute here, and a fun thing for you to end on here, because everyone's talking about it, watching it constantly. The Olympics. Tell me each, both of you, what are you watching, Stacey?
I am so excited for ping pong. I can't believe I'm saying that out loud. But you have to watch. Everyone has to watch The Art of Those Serves.
The Art of Those Serves in ping pong. All right, Jaime.
Well, I was going to say breakdancing, but the truth is, I think basketball, men and women's basketball, there's always exciting to watch.
We got Durant, we got Kevin or Devin Booker in there. I mean, this is good stuff.
That's right.
All
Arizona's
right.
Well represented.
Well represented at the Olympics. We will leave it there for now. That is Jaime Molera, former state school superintendent, now with Molera Alvarez and Stacey Pearson with Lumen Strategies, joining us for the Friday Newscap. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a few podcast recommendations for your final summer road trip or daily commute. But first, ranchers in Arizona weigh in on some of the biggest issues facing the state, including water, the border, and illegal immigration. They've also made their opinions known on concerns that may be more specific to their industry, the advent of lab-grown meat and wolf populations across the West, for example. Our next guest has studied the politics and political influence of ranchers. Michelle Berry is an assistant professor in the Departments of History and Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Arizona and author of the book Cow Talk, Work, Ecology, and Range Cattle Ranchers in the Post-War Mountain West. She grew up in the 80s in western Colorado, surrounded by agriculture, and says her dad did some cattle ranching as well. Her research was sparked by an interest in wanting to know more about the people around whom she grew up. Berry spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, who asked if what she found confirmed what she'd thought in her childhood or if it differed from her own experiences.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. No, it didn't, actually. So I'm an environmental historian by training and also a labor historian. So I'm kind of interested in work and the ways in which the more than human informs human cultures and human workscapes, if you will. And so obviously cattle ranching is a really good setting for that kind of work. And I remember from my younger years just thinking about the ways in which cattle ranchers were not really antithetical to quote-unquote environmentalism. They cared quite a bit about the range, and maybe they didn't love every species of wildlife, wolves, coyotes, et cetera, but they did have an environmental sensibility that I think sometimes was mischaracterized by environmentalists and by those who were not cattle ranchers. And so I found in my research that, in fact, ranchers really were, even in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, very focused on trying to do the right thing by the range and because they wanted to do the right thing by their cows. Hmm. I also was really interested in powerful female ranchers that I had contact with as a younger person. My mom was a cowbell. And so that women's auxiliary of these cattle growers associations was really, really powerful and really active in these years. So that was really fun to investigate all of that too.
Did you find that in some ways women on the ranches had maybe more power, more rights, more authority than they did in other segments of life in America at that time?
I think, you know, white, and of course, most of my book is about Anglo cattle ranchers. I didn't do anything with reservation ranchers. And so this is really mostly about Anglo cattle ranchers. And so if we think about cattle ranchers as maybe quote unquote middle class, right? They're a rural class, but they are also kind of, you know, rich in land, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And if we think about middle class white women in the 1950s and 60s in the United States, their world, although they're doing a lot more than we often think of them as doing. Their worlds were a bit circumscribed by gendered ideals, you know, at home, having, you know, maybe living in the suburbs, having multiple children, vacuuming the living room in high heel shoes, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And these ranch women are doing not that. So they are doing tremendous domestic labor. They do a lot of laundry. They do the cooking, but they're also very much laboring in the ranch environs. And they are really proud of their identity as ranchers and as partners in the ranch business. And so I think that sets them apart. There's a kind of feminism there that is really interesting. And then they do this tremendous labor of sort of getting together and creating community and making sure that there's almost a PR kind of labor that they do for the cattle ranching business itself.
Well, so you mentioned that you wanted to look at what brought ranchers together during this time period. What was it? What did bring them together?
Cows. It sounds so just silly, simple, but
makes sense.
Really, it does make sense. And that's kind of the title of the book, is that their ability to talk about cows, to privilege their cattle, to privilege the process of growing cows was really what gave them cause to come together, to talk about things. And in addition to that, there's this tremendous change that's happening in the U.S. Mountain West during these decades, right? It's the post-war. We're seeing an increase in metropolitan areas, Phoenix probably being the best example of that. And ranchers sensed that change. Not only did they have a new federal government present in grazing regulations, they also are starting to sense that there's this incursion of recreationists, of hunters that don't know what the heck is going on. There's increasing highway construction. So there's a lot of things that are happening to ranchers that inspire them to come together and try to figure out how to handle those changes and how to talk to one another about those changes and advocate for their quote unquote way of life.
How did ranchers go about trying to gain this, I guess let's call it political power, in terms of making sure that policies that affected them were what they wanted and maybe even getting, you know, fellow ranchers elected to policy-making positions?
So they create their livestock associations in the late 19th century, mostly to handle what they called rustling, right, which was the stealing of their cattle, quote unquote, from the open range, right? Of course, we know that it wasn't open. We know that it was native land and all of those things, but they believed their cows to be their private property and that folks who were taking those cattle were stealing. And so rustling was the primary cause for the creation of the livestock associations. And then those membership in those associations declines a bit in the 20s and especially the 30s with the Great Depression. But they come back in the 40s and 50s. So they increase the numbers of members in these associations in every state in the book. And then within those organizations, and this is still true today, they have a variety of committees. So ranchers serve on a variety of committees that have all different kinds of topics. And then the folks who are on those committees reach out to their elected officials. Oftentimes they would labor to get ranchers elected to public office, especially the state legislatures. They petition the federal government agencies quite a bit, especially the USDA, the Forest Service, et cetera. And so their political activism comes through their associations And then it takes a variety of forms.
Do ranchers tend to have, maybe did they then and do they now, are they pretty much in agreement on particular issues? Or is there a wide range of opinions on what policies might be best?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. And I think they're just like any other cultural group that comes together for reasons about power. They have lots of disagreements, and part of it is talking through those disagreements and trying to ascertain compromise and to figure out probably what the best path forward is. One of those examples is the role of state government and even federal government in things like quarantine or required vaccination programs for diseases in the 50s and 60s. So they don't all agree, but they also recognize that they have a lot in common, and it's in their best interest to try to speak with common language, with a kind of commonality that I think a lot of cultural groups do when they try to politically organize.
I'm curious, when you look at the political influence of ranchers and the ranching community now, how would you describe it?
Well, it's so interesting. Brian Calvert, who writes for the High Country News, calls it the political power of the cowboy. And I think if we look at kind of numbers, right, there were so many range cattle ranchers in the 40s and 50s. So their political power kind of numerically made some sense, geographically made some sense. Their numbers are decreasing, as we know, as we move into through the 21st century. And yet they still have this power to speak and this power to advocate for public policy that may be incommensurate with their actual numbers. But I still think they're incredibly powerful. And they're powerful in the imagination of the Mountain West. That political power of the cowboy, meaning the iconography, the values that ranch culture seemed to promote, you know. And I think that still has had a staying power, so that when ranchers do speak, when they do lobby, when they do advocate for their needs, they have to still have tremendous power, I think. Although I think they're starting to lose some of that power. And certainly they thought they were losing that power even as early as the 1950s. They were already fearing erasure from the landscape of the Mountain West, which is fascinating. If those folks could see what's happening now, they'd be really surprised, I think.
Michelle, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Michelle Berry is an assistant professor in the Departments of History and Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Arizona and author of the book Cow Talk, Work, Ecology, and Range Cattle Ranchers in the Postwar Mountain West.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Summer is coming to a rapid end, even though it's still blazing outside here in the valley. And that means a lot of us will be heading out on that last summer road trip to escape the heat. And whether you're escaping town or just getting back to your regular daily commute, we here at the show thought it was time for some podcast recommendations. But you open that podcast app and where do you begin? Well, that conundrum is our next guest's specialty. Ariel Nissenblatt is the founder of the Earbuds Podcast Collective and host of the weekly podcast recommendation audio newsletter, Feedback with Earbuds.
Yeah, it can be extremely overwhelming to find podcasts to listen to. And that is actually the reason I got into the podcast space. I didn't have any experience on the microphone or as a producer or as a reporter, anything. So I was like, how can I insert myself into this industry? Ah, I can help people find their next favorite podcast to listen to.
Yeah.
So my whole thing is discovery, helping people find their next favorite listen. I started a podcast recommendation newsletter, and then I discovered a wide world of other podcast recommendation newsletters. So it's a combination of reading those every time they come out and then noticing what's also trending on the podcast apps and also what's being cross-promoted on other podcasts that I love. Those tend to be really great ways for me to discover podcasts.
Okay, I like that. That's a solid start. So thinking of what's popular in the podcasting industry right now, like I know it kind of goes through waves, but what are we looking at in summer in terms of genres? Like, are we still looking at a ton of true crime and people
Always.
Really being into that?
Yes, that will never end. There is something about true crime that really gets people. But here's the hope that I feel is that I think while true crime is big, what really has been big the last 2 years, and it continues to be a trend, is true crime focused on scams and fraud so that there's no blood and death and gore. It's really just somebody got duped, and that sucks.
A slightly less doom and gloom. Okay, I get
exactly.
It. What about the conversational podcast? Like, is that still king? Like, I mean, there's the Joe Rogan Show and Call Her Daddy, like some of the really big ones, but that was like kind of the mode, right? Like the format for a long time. Is that still true?
It is definitely still true, and it is what a lot of both listeners look for and advertisers look for, because it's easy to keep those shows always on and always to be selling ads against them. Mm. They're the easiest to produce. They're the easiest to constantly have content for, whereas if you have a 6-episode limited series, it's probably a really great story, but it will end after 6 episodes, and then what do you do with that whole new podcast on your podcast feed? You can drop other episodes into that feed, but you can't really do much with that original intellectual property.
Yeah. And so anything you love along this line, like these often bleed into pop culture, kind of gossipy podcasts. Mm-hmm. What are you listening to?
So right now, there's a podcast that is still dropping new episodes as we're recording this. It's called Tested. It's from NPR's Embedded and CBC, and it's hosted by Rose Eveleth, who used to host a podcast that was really amazing called Flash Forward. Mm-hmm. Tested is about being tested for whether or not an athlete is female enough to compete in the Olympics under the female category. Mm-hmm. The story is pretty nuts, and I highly recommend it. They focus on some specific people that have competed in the past and are no longer able to compete, or who have decided to take drugs to lower their natural testosterone level.
Hmm. So that kind of bleeds into news too, right? Like there's some real reporting and journalism behind that. What about news podcasts? Like how do they stack up to the more fun ones that we all love to listen to?
News podcasts are huge right now. I actually, when it was announced that Biden was dropping out of the race, and immediately I tweeted something like, happy emergency podcast recording to anybody who participates, because you just know that all the news podcasts had to jump on and record an update to their latest politically minded rant that they went on.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're huge. There are always a lot of podcasts that pop up during the election season that maybe just run for a few months and then stop. The New York Times has a podcast called The Run Up with Ested Herndon, which is really great and is ramping up content as we get closer to November.
Right.
I am somebody who listens to like 6 to 7 news podcasts every day. Sometimes they're long, sometimes they're short. So I wake up every day and I listen to The Daily Zeitgeist. It's actually twice a day. It's morning and afternoon, about an hour each. I listen to Up First from NPR. I listen to NYC Now because I'm based in New York City. It's 3 times a day, 5 minutes each, just what's going on in New York and the implications for the broader world. I always listen to Today Explained from Vox. And I'll leave it at that. There's more, but that's enough.
That's enough. Many I recognize there. Some we air on our station.
Yay.
I have to ask about family-friendly podcasts, like even podcasts hosted by kids. I have little kids, and I've been looking for these, and they're harder to find, I think, than they should be. But tell me where to go.
The 10 News is great. It's a podcast that is co-hosted by kids and adults, and it is quick, and it is a few times a week, and they focus on tough topics, but they explain it for kids, and it's just a really great way for kids to hear themselves represented in the news.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so new shows that you're into, different topics, different genres, is there something that we might not be expecting or looking for that we should go and look for?
Yes, a podcast that I resisted for a long time and then listened to in probably a weekend is called Inconceivable Truth. Hmm. It's 8 episodes. It's hosted by Matt Katz, who is a reporter at WNYC. It is the story of how Matt Katz found out that he thought for his whole life that he was 100% Ashkenazi Jewish, and then he found out that he was only 50%. So it's a whole look into who his father actually is, and he goes on this quest, and then it turns out to be about the fertility industry, and it is riveting.
Huh. I love that. I want to listen right now. Okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a broad question before we let you go, like about the industry itself, because you're clearly so plugged in. Like a lot of the headlines for a long time now have been that the podcasting industry is like imploding, like there aren't jobs left, that shows are being canceled, networks are falling. Like, what does that look like? Are we past that?
There was an article that came out about 2 weeks ago from Ashley Carman, who is a writer at Bloomberg, who covers the podcast and music industries, talking about how we are finally on the upswing. I have been lucky to be employed for this downturn. I'm very grateful for that because I work on the tech side of the podcast industry. And it is true that the media side of things has definitely taken a loss. So has the advertising arm of things. Mm-hmm. But there are independent podcasters who will continue to independently podcast, and that fire cannot be stamped out.
Okay. Okay. And then my final question is more fun, right? I want to ask you about the summer road trip. It's kind of winding down summer. Everybody's going to go on their last road trip here. What is the kind of podcast you like to listen to if you're driving for a long time? And what would you recommend?
I love this question. I recommend game shows. So I have two.
That makes
one
sense,
is
yeah.
called Pod Quiz. There are over 1,000 episodes. They just celebrated their, I think, 1,007th episode.
Wow.
It's hosted by this guy, James Carter, in the UK. It's 20 questions, and it is family friendly, and you answer out loud. And then if you want to submit, you can submit, and it's kind of on the honor system, but it's such a great listen, and I'm constantly speaking out loud to myself while I listen to it.
That sounds like a good, it's like a road trip game as well at the same
exactly.
time.
Yeah. Exactly. And the second game podcast is called The Puzzler from AJ Jacobs, who is the writer of My Year of Living Biblically and recently The Year of Living Constitutionally. Mm-hmm. And this is a daily podcast, also very quick. It's usually 5 to 7 minutes. AJ will have on a different person, and he creates games specifically for that person that are still also exciting to the listener. And again, you can answer out loud and learn a few new things, mostly word games, but sometimes history and other things are weaved in there as well.
That sounds great. All right. A ton of great recommendations for all of our listening pleasure. That is Arielle Nissenblatt, founder of Earbuds Podcast Collective and host of Feedback with Earbuds, joining us. Arielle, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for breaking this all down. Great recommendations. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Our staff here at the show loves podcasts, obviously, so we also put together a playlist for you of our favorite podcasts right now. And from History is Sexy to If Books Could Kill, it's a pretty great list. To check it out, head to our website, theshow.kjzz.org, and happy listening. Here in Phoenix, we know all too well that it's a dry heat and that it's essential to stay hydrated. So for many of us, the most important summer accessory isn't flip-flops or sunglasses. It's a water bottle. Earlier this year, the show's Amber Victoria Singer lost her beloved Hydro Flask. Here she is with the backstory.
January 10th, 2024 is the last day I saw my beloved Hydro Flask. For 5 years, I carried a lavender water bottle with me everywhere. And I mean everywhere. That thing was by my side at concerts, brunches, farmers markets, and movie theaters. It was a magnet for stickers, which made it feel like a representation of who I was and what I liked. There was a handful of stickers from local bands, a blue foam finger announcing KJZZ's status as Arizona's number one news station, a woman with purple hair holding 3 cats proclaiming my status as a cat lady. You get the idea. It was a warm Wednesday evening when I realized I left my companion behind. We were filming a tiny desert concert that day, and I was so tired that I did not realize it wasn't in my backpack until I walked all the way home. I figured the dog walkers and skateboarders out at that hour would pass it without a second thought. But by the time I made my way back to the alleyway behind the church hill, it was gone. I wasn't too worried at first. Once, I had to track down my friend's friend's dad's friend's daughter in order to get that Hydro Flask back. This time, I had no leads, but I was determined. So I printed out 25 flyers advertising a $35 reward. Armed with a staple gun and a roll of packing tape, I plastered telephone poles and streetlights around the scene of the crime. "Missing Hydro Flask," the flyers read in big purple letters. Underneath, there were 3 pictures of the subject, including one of me kissing it. That was from the last time it went missing. I added the message, "Please help me find her. I'm so sad." I included my Instagram handle because it seemed safer than my phone number or my email address. The next morning, I received a direct message from someone called Burger. He said he'd been drinking wine out of my Hydro Flask, but was happy to return it. I was so excited that my plan actually worked. For 2 days, Berger sidestepped my DM requests for a photo of the missing Hydro Flask, citing a roommate with uncontrollable seizures and a jealous baby mama. In the end, Berger claimed his baby mama sold it online. I should have known better than to trust someone with a hand-drawn cheeseburger as a profile picture. "It's a tough city, Amber," he told me in our final exchange. "You might need to move to Scottsdale." Ouch. Over the next few weeks, I received a number of messages. Some seemed genuinely concerned, and others were after the $35 reward. Amused onlookers and a couple of local photographers posted pictures of the flyers on social media. Tired of my newfound, unwanted fame, I tore down as many flyers as I could find. I had already caved and bought a new water bottle 8 days after my Hydro Flask went missing. I felt like I was cheating on it. We had been through so much together, but to be honest, it was time. The stickers were peeling and it leaked. A lot. My new plain, white, leak-proof Owala water bottle feels like a clean slate. It only took me a month to lose this new water bottle. I designed another missing poster in my head as I rushed back to the last place I saw it. Thankfully, I wouldn't have to print any more flyers. My water bottle was still sitting in the grass where I'd left it.
That was the show's Amber Victoria Singer with an essay that originally aired this spring as part of our Soapbox series. You can hear it again and find more stories at kjzz.org.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. We will be back with you again on Monday morning with much more, all the news you can handle. Head to Instagram if you want to follow us there. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
And the hillsides enough to climb. There are oceans and rivers enough to cross.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.